You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284 AL Haleiwa, K224 CQ Anahola. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals and your friends and your family. This is your host, Paul Massey. I'm the director of Regenerations Botanical Garden. On today, we're going to enjoy some audio highlights from a new documentary film on tropical permaculture. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with our generous underwriters.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda garden and lawn equipment and also Echo power equipment. 823-0556.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
The Kauai store is located in Kapa'a on the highway in front of Kostilas. The store has authentic Kauai products including clothing, snacks, art, coffee, crafts, and more. We even have local food samples. The Kauai store products are also available online at thekauaistore.com.
Well, thank you so much to our sponsors, and we're listening to a little Peter Gabriel, a CD I was able to grab off the shelf running in here from the studio, into the studio, just fresh out of the Kauai Food Forest, where we've got a great workday happening today, taking down a bunch of nitrogen, fixing trees, and mulching. We're getting ready for a celebration on the 13th of December, Sunday, to be held at the Kauai Food Forest in Kalihiwai to celebrate the third anniversary of the plantings there. And the project was truly inspired by permaculture principles, perspective, awareness, and strategies. And that is the focus of the film that we are going to listen to excerpts from, relatively new film on tropical permaculture, so very applicable to us here in Hawaii, was actually created in Thailand, but the film is available and you can watch it online. But we're going to get to the audio portion. It's a very nice film to look at, but you can really capture a lot of the lessons from the excerpts that we've chosen to share with you today. So without further ado, Seeds of Permaculture is the film. And we're going to have a listen. Thanks so much for tuning into the Garden Show and sharing this love of plants and nature and all of the earth.
One of the reasons we're shooting this film, and we haven't even really touched on it yet, is global climate change. All around the world, as you know, places are experiencing odd weather events. Right now, we're in Bangkok, Thailand. It's the end of March, the dry season in Thailand, and it's not supposed to be any rain. What's happening behind me, this stormy kind of weather is intended for June, July, August, September. But here it is happening in March. This is the new normal in this world. all around the world, whether you're in South America, in North America, in Europe, in Asia, people are experiencing weather patterns that are out of the norm. So one of the reasons that permaculture is getting so popular right now, growing faster than ever before on an exponential curve of growth, is because our planet needs it. It's time for the important changes that permaculture has to give.
Come to our PVC courses are really in this wonderful, interesting time in their lives where they're right on the edge of deciding what they want for their life. They've done college or most of their college life, then maybe they've entered into a career, and they're just thinking, this isn't really doing it for me. And as far as I'm seeing from the world, it's not going to get any better. For an alternative. They're looking for a way to change what's going to play out in their lives. They're starting to take it in their own hands.
While I care about nutrition and health care, I have a bigger concern about conservation and sustainability. What we're doing right now isn't working.
We stopped farming because the land was no good, and wanted it to be a real family thing like it was with my grandfather and my great-grandfather.
The people are becoming less and less self-sufficient around the world. These local communities that were previously growing everything themselves and knew how to build their own houses out of natural materials are completely dependent on big foreign powers and imports from other countries.
So I guess I've grown up around heaps of trees and the rainforest and animals, and I've always had that connection with nature, and so if I'm away from it, I feel like something's missing, and so that's what brought me here, was to learn about a new culture and learn about the different kind of environments and habitat.
One of the challenges that permaculture has out in front of it is proving to the world that it can be a viable form of profitable agriculture. Through the development of a master plan for your site or your project, it's possible to really lay out enhancement strategies that make it more likely that you and your project can become profitable. One of the most important aspects to our ecological farm here is the making of compost, about improving the soil and constantly bringing more organic matter and more life into the soil. The compost production process is actually really easy, and it's accessible to anyone. It doesn't take expensive parts. It doesn't take that much space. All you need are three simple ingredients, and those ingredients can come from any number of sources. We're going to use brown matter, which on this farm we use corn husks for, because they produced a bunch of corn at this farm, and this was kind of tossed aside to be used later. So using corn husks as our brown matter. It's going to be the high carbon component of our compost pile. Then we need green matter. You're looking for green leafy matter. The green color in the leaf indicates that there's still quite a bit of nitrogen left in it. If I was to leave this out in the sun, after a couple days, it would turn brown, and that's indicating that the nitrogen has been lost into the atmosphere. So we want to cut it fresh, use it fresh in our compost pile. We just had a bunch of weeds around our farm, and this morning we went out and collected them up and put them in a big pile. And as we add it to the compost pile, we're going to chop it into little bits. We also have a bunch of food scraps from the kitchen that we're going to layer into the pile as well. And that also is considered part of our green component. For the nitrogen component of the compost pile, generally we use manure in the pile. You can get away with using the greens from legume plants because they're also high in nitrogen. But we're going to use, in our local area, there's lots of cows around, so we just went to some local farmers and got their manure from them. And so we're just using some manure out of their cow yards. So we'll layer this in along with the green and the brown and add moisture and oxygen, and that'll make our compost pile.
Here, all the different countries represented, the place can reach some kind of resilience.
Another important component to our compost pile is an inoculum of microorganisms from the previous compost pile. So we're going to take some high-quality compost that we produced previously and sprinkle it into our pile as we're making the layers. That way, all the bacterial life, all the fungal life, and the microorganisms that are thriving in this pile will be added to that pile, and will start to just flourish as we create the right conditions. This is going to make our new compost pile beautiful and wonderful for our site. All right, when we go to build our compost piles, we need to get the correct proportions of our different components. What we're looking for is a 30-to-1 carbon to nitrogen ratio in our pile. Generally, we do it based on recipes and then adjust your pile as you go. So one of the most common recipes is a 40% brown matter, 40% green matter, and 20% high nitrogen. So then you layer those in your pile, watering it pretty heavily the entire time, and then let it sit. Now, depending on what materials you're using, you're going to have to adjust that. So what you're going to need to do is build your pile with the materials you have readily available to you in your area, and then see how it goes. If the pile gets too hot, which we often experience here in the tropics because the microbes are so active and so ready to do their job, that means we have too much nitrogen in the pile. So when you go to turn the pile, we should mix in a little bit more carbon matter. That can be sawdust, that can be strips of paper, and that can be our corn husks that we're using here. If your pile is not really doing anything, it's not really getting hot, it doesn't seem to be breaking down, that means you don't have enough nitrogen. So basically get a little bit more manure or a little bit more of your legume greens and mix those in as you're turning the pile. If your pile just smells completely like sewage, if it just smells like, then that's a sign that it's going anaerobic, which means you don't have enough oxygen in the pile. It's really important that we don't allow the compost pile to go anaerobic. So the best method for that is to acquire a compost thermometer and watch the temperature of the pile. We want to watch the temperature going up to about 65 degrees Celsius. At 65 degrees Celsius, then we want to turn the pile, get more air into it, and allow it to go through its process again. If the pile gets to 70 degrees Celsius, it's going to start killing beneficial microbial life. There's two main reasons why that would happen. One is that the pile is too wet, which means you just need to add more dry material or spread the pile out a little bit and let it dry out. The other reason why it might be going anaerobic is that you have too much nitrogen. And so the nitrogen is reacting a lot and eating up all the oxygen really quickly before it can re-aerate itself. So really important to keep our piles as an aerated pile. So with those tricks and over a couple of times of trying it, you should become really comfortable at making a really high quality compost.
Listening to the audio portion, excerpts from the film Seeds of Permaculture, this is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio.
Oh yeah, there's one other thing. If you're not so concerned about creating the best quality compost, but instead want to focus on making hot water for showers, you can run a black plastic tubing through the pile and get the pile to get up to those really high temperatures, and you can have hot water for weeks.
So after big days of work, we like to have a good shower, and like having a simple life doesn't mean that we have to get rid of all the comfort. So this little system here that's very, very easy to install, it's just basically a big black tank, is our water heating system that allow us to have a 200 liter of hot water every night when we want to take a shower. So it's very easy, just get a glass in the front and some insulation on the sides, It's pretty easy to make. My guess would be, I think, in the thinking, probably like half a day to make the design, another half a day to collect the materials, and then probably let's take like 2 days to build it properly and to make the connections and everything. And thanks to the to this system, it's about 200 liters of water, which allows about 20 people to take a nice hot shower every evening. And when we open the tap, the water is fed by gravity, comes through the tank, and that allows us to all have a nice shower every evening after a big muddy day of work.
When a client approaches us about having a master plan done for their project, we go through a whole series of steps to make that happen. We start generally with a goals analysis of their site, of their family, of their project, of their enterprise that they're wanting us to work on. After that, we generally do a site analysis. We'll do a visit to the site, spend a number of days, up to a week with the client, establishing what are the pre-existing structures on site, what resources are available to the project, and what might be useful in terms of moving forward with the design. After that, we go back to the drawing board and start scratching ideas, working with each other, working with the team of designers, and figuring out what is the most appropriate set of strategies and techniques which might bring about achieving the goals for this family, for this enterprise, for this project.
Protect against that, so that's something we've already learned. It can be a lesson learned.
And it's a direct resource from the local community right here. So every single bot is going to those people that work for it. Mm-hmm. They didn't buy anything at Tesco Lotus to be able to supply those materials, which is nice.
Ultimately, with the master plan, what we're looking for is to achieve our holistic goals. We want the economics of the site to be in line. We want the ecology of the site to be continuously improving. And we want the personal needs of the residents there to be met. In the fields behind me, we're implementing a combination of orchard, food forest, and alley cropping corn systems over here. One of the first steps we're going to go in to do with this is to put in swales. About 600 meters of swales, 3 contoured lines of swales they put in behind me in the coming months. Now, those swales primarily are intended to sink in all the water that falls during the rainy season and benefit the land throughout the year. That water will penetrate the soil and be held down in the water table and be accessible to the plants throughout the year. The benefits of the infiltration of water from the swale system will be felt on this land and beyond. Additional water into the water tables and accessible water to all the plants on site will bring a lot more greenery to this land throughout the dry season. Amount of growth that's taken place in the short 9-month period here. I mean, this was just cornfields 9 months ago. I'm surrounded by a sea of legume trees, fixing nitrogen, creating shade, and even providing food for the community here. This plant here is a pigeon pea. It's one of a permaculture all-stars in the tropical climate. We can eat the shoots off the plant, we can eat the seeds off the plant, and all the while it's fixing nitrogen. There's edibles around me, there's young fruit trees around me, and basically, for as far as I can see on this land, is a water harvesting swale that over the course of the last 9 months has probably harvested in the area of 20 million liters of water.
Perfect.
Through the implementation of these enhancement strategies, we're looking to reduce erosion, to build healthier soil, to increase yields, and in turn, make it more profitable for the farmers here.
Ever since I discovered this pile a couple of days ago, we find ourselves returning here often, mostly because it has the most dense microbial life of any soil on the farm.
Yeah, that's true. It's a wonderful resource for microbes, especially here. They're starting, a new farm, and they need to build soil to really improve soil fertility.
And we would expect that this pile has the best microbial life because it provides the best environment on the farm for those microbes. It has all the food that these microbes need, and the cover on top is protecting it from the sun and holding the moisture inside. So the microbes in here have everything they need to be growing and flourishing, and they haven't really touched this pile in 2 years, so it hasn't been turned like the agricultural fields, so there's no disturbance for the microbes, so they can just grow freely. We were invited here to teach about the soils and set up a basic soil biology lab, which is really exciting for us because the soils are something that nobody really even talks about or understands, and it's just so important because there's so much life underneath the soil.
In 1 teaspoon of good, healthy soil, there are over 1 billion bacteria, 900 feet of fungi, 50,000 protozoa, and several dozen nematodes.
It's feeding the plant, right? So we always this idea that we need the nitrogen and the fertilizers to feed the plant to make them grow. But for millennia, Mother Nature has been feeding the plants and making everything on Earth grow without our input. And it's these soil microbes which do that.
The plants have a relationship with the soil microbes, which allows them to obtain all the nutrients that the plants need in the soil. The microbes help produce good soil structure. They cycle various nutrients such as nitrogen, sulfur, phosphorus. They interact with each other at the root zone of the plant and provide all the nutrition the plant needs.
So we all know that the plant undergoes photosynthesis. Like the sun hits it, there's the chloroplast, it creates these sugars, and we all think that's what it uses to make itself grow. But really, a plant is taking more than half of that, like 60% of all the energy that it grows, that it makes from the sun, and it's feeding it through these root exudates to the microorganisms in the soil. These little guys, these fungi, these bacteria, they can't photosynthesize, so they rely on the plant to get all the food that it needs, but there's a little trade going on here. So in exchange for the sugars that the plant is giving it, the soil microbes are providing the food that the plant needs to grow.
It's really important to understand the difference between an orchard and a food forest. An orchard is kind of less intensively managed area. Usually it's larger in size and focuses on one or two species, with the whole purpose being high production of those one or two species to send to market. Food forest is usually in much smaller in area, a little bit more intensively managed. It has multi functions. It has many more functions than the orchard does. So once this food forest is finished, we hope to have mimicked many of the layers of the forest, of a natural forest, including the trees, shrubs, herbs, and vine layers. What we're actually doing here right now is trying to take the orchard and turn it into a food forest. We've actively tilled this land. We're gonna alley crop in the meantime until these trees get quite a bit bigger. And currently we're adding in different herbs and vegetables to the understory of the trees. Right now, they're planting cassava cuttings. Cassava is a pretty incredible plant in that it's so versatile in the tropics. It can grow in a desert situation. It can grow in a really wet situation. It's not the most nutritious food item, but it is a security plant. We look at it if there is some sort of emergency, if there's a huge drought, or if there's a hurricane that wipes out all the fruit crops off the trees, we can still dig up these giant roots of cassava and get the needed calories. One of the features that's missing from this orchard, an important feature to transition it into food forest, is the addition of legumes. Legumes are a classification of plants that the vast majority of them fix nitrogen into the soil. It's really important through a interaction with bacteria in the soil. The bacteria is able to pull nitrogen out of the air and add it into the soil. This is a huge boon for us. Some of the important species that we're going to use in the legume family are Gliricidia. Gliricidia is a really great tropical legume in that you can plant it by cuttings. Very similar to the cassava cuttings back here. You can just chop it into little 1 foot lengths. And as long as you plant it the right way up, it will grow. Another great one is Leucaena. Leucaena grows around here really commonly. Some of the Thai people consider it somewhat of a pest, but the multiple functions of leucaena make it well worth planting it out here. It's a fodder for animals. It fixes nitrogen in the soil. It's a great chop-and-drop nitrogen-fixing plant because you chop it in during the rainy season, chop it up in little bits, put it around these fruit trees, and by just a few months later, the sprouts are growing big again. And by the dry season, it's putting up enough shade to keep these trees healthy and happy. A third great nitrogen-fixing plant, which we're actually planting today, is pigeon pea. I can't wait to just be able to come out here and pick my own jackfruits and durians and star apples and jujubes and atamoyas, soursops, here's jackfruits, oranges, pomelos, pineapples on the ground, Jamaican cherry, and oh, when durian season comes around, it's going to be so good. Loquats and Suriname cherries, mangosteens, the queen of fruit, lychee. After a little bit closer examination of this woman's yard, I can identify at least 12 varieties of edible, almost all perennials that are existing in this backyard food forest. Straight behind me here is the overstory of this area, the jackfruit tree. A tree that produces more fruit in terms of kilos per year than any other fruit on the planet. Beyond the jackfruit tree, which is actually in a neighbor's yard, you can see what they call Gloi Hom in Thai, which is the kind of Western-style banana that's the big, long ones. There's actually jackfruits on the tree. I can see about 10 of them just in the lower branches. And as we come closer here, you got papaya growing, some nice Thai papaya. Also, as we start to walk around this garden, there's a couple different varieties of eggplants. Here's the Thai-style eggplant, the little round version. And right here, a little closer, are the longer version, a little bit closer to the Western style. These ones have gone beyond eating, beyond the best point for eating, but they can be still saved for seeds. This is lemongrass. I'm sure it's used almost every day in the family's cooking. There's more of the traditional Thai banana behind us. There's actually a couple small bunches of them that are kind of like a little ladyfinger style bananas, much smaller, much more flavorful than the bananas we have in the West. You can see beyond these little papayas here, you can see a little bunch of bananas up in the tree there. And as we pan around that way, we've got the kaffir lime. This plant is used often in Thai cooking. In the coconut milk soup, they use this, and they often fry it with peanuts and other things. Really amazing, delicious herb. Kind of on the ground here, in the wetter area in the yard, this wet-loving plant called pandanus, which is used often in, it's this plant here. Used often in desserts and herbal drinks in Thailand. Some others hanging from the tree up here. They look like little small perennial cucumbers on it that you can eat, but what's most often eaten in Thailand is just the shoots off of this plant. So I don't know how many I just named, but there's close to 12. And another one, which I saw popping up over in the corner over there, which I don't even think they planted, was some amaranth. Probably just a weed for this family, but totally pickable and edible in their stir fries. Beautiful. If we can get our food forest to look half as good, we're golden.
So we've looked at how a food forest is made, and if you haven't got enough space for a forest, you can always make a garden in your backyard. So when people think of gardening, they might think of food, maybe soil, maybe even hard work. But for me, when I think of gardening, I think empowerment, because my garden is a little mini revolution in itself. It's a way for us to work from the grassroots and really cut the ties between this big business and agribiz, which causes all this environmental degradation. And if every dollar that I'm spending is saying I support you, then I'm just not willing to support supermarket chains. So it also means a lot about nutrition for me as well. When I searched the world for what was the healthiest thing to put into my body, and I read and read, and I found in every book it always went back to the healthiest thing you can eat is something that's picked directly from a plant and put directly into your mouth. And this is like healthy soil, healthy plants, healthy humans. It's also really cheap. You know, you can grow a lot of food in a very small area for not much money.
You're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. This is In the Garden on the Farm, and we're listening to the audio excerpts from Seeds of Permaculture.
Pharmaceutical companies use the gardens, the herbs and spices and the root plants that are growing right in our garden beds. They put loads of chemicals in and use loads of fossil fuels and then sell it to us where we've got it growing in our own garden beds. So let's just cut that tie altogether. So if we're thinking about gardens, we can think cheap, we can think easy, you can meet your neighbours, you can meet your local community by learning from the garden and learning from your surroundings. And it's fun. It's so much fun to garden. Watching things grow can be really beautiful. So here in the tropics, there's a few really good strategies that you can use in your garden. One would be mulch. A lot of the everything's kept in the biomass in the tropics, so we need to cover our soil with as much organic matter as you can, and that can be straw, or you can grow your own mulch, lemongrass or comfrey, throw anything onto the soil as long as it's covered. Another one would be water. So when we're facing the wet and dry season of a tropics, we have to really design around our water systems. So one good water strategy in the tropics is using swales or planting on contour, like Jeff I was speaking about. Another good strategy is using drip line irrigation, which you would place underneath the mulch, and that waters the plant exactly, because we're trying to reduce, reuse and recycle as much water as we can. So you can also use things like grey water. That's a really good use of grey water, is into your garden beds. Another good strategy in tropical gardening is weed barriers. So in the tropics, we have huge bursts of growth in the wet season. And they're all there for a reason. In permaculture, we think the problem is the solution. So we look at a weed and try and work out how can that be our solution. And a lot of weeds are doing the things that we want them to do. They're covering the soil and protecting it, which gives us the amazing plants. So covering the soil would be the first thing that you would do when you're trying to stop the weeds coming up. So that comes back to mulch again. That cuts down a lot of our weeding needs. And you can also plant weed barriers. So put things around the edges of your garden that can stop the weeds from coming in. That can be logs or bricks or rocks or anything. Or you can plant weed barriers, and that way you've got veg and things growing around the edge of your garden that you can harvest from as well. Things like comfrey, again, lemongrass, canna lilies, day lilies, edible flowers. Plant them around the edges of your garden, and you're going to have extra things to harvest from and stop the weeds. So there's a couple of permaculture plants that I love to use in the tropics. One is comfrey. Comfrey is one of my favourites. It's amazing, amazing plant. It can do so many things, as I said before, with the weed barriers. It's really good. It grows in a big clump, so it stops any weeds from coming in. It's also what we call a dynamic accumulator. So it sends taproots really deep down in the soil and pulls out loads of nutrients that aren't accessible to other plants. And it stores them in really concentrated forms in the leaves. Then when the plant dies down in over the season, the nutrients become accessible to all the plants around. So that's really super good for the plants. And because it has so high nutrients in the leaves, it's really good for making weed teas. So you just ferment it in water and then spray that over your garden, diluted, and it's just like a little fertilizer. You can also use it as a compost accelerator. If you put it in your compost, it makes it go way faster. Even just a few leaves does the trick. It's also a medicinal plant. They call it nip bone in some places. The Roman soldiers never used to march in war unless they had comfrey and garlic. They were the two antiseptic, antibacterial, anti-amazingness of plants. The other really good plant that we use a lot in tropical permaculture is neem. And this is a really good pioneer plant. The Christian probably spoke a bit in the food forest about plants that pioneer same year up. It's a really fast-growing tree, and it's also very medicinal. The Indians eat like 5 leaves a day, and neem leaf a day keeps the doctor away. It's really bitter, but amazing for every part of your body, building immunity, immune system. It's really good for digestion. You can even use the branches to brush your teeth with. There's oil. You can get oil from the leaves and from the fruit, and from that you can use, make shampoos, and you can make detergents, and it gets rid of things like lice and fleas, so it's excellent for your animals too. And because it's such a bitter leaf, it's really good insecticide, a natural insecticide, so you can turn it into a spray and keep all the bugs away. And because of that, you can also use it as a mulch on your garden, and that prevents pests and things from coming into your garden as well. So both of these plants are my favourite. Grey water is something that we can utilise to the extreme. There's so many nutrients and amazing things that come from grey water. And grey water is anything that comes from your kitchen sink, your shower, your bathroom sink, and black water comes from your toilet. From your kitchen, you put a grease trap and then directly into your banana circle. So you can be washing your plates in the evening time and watering your banana circle, which is right at your door. And banana circle is a really beautiful way of using tropical permaculture. To make a banana circle, you basically dig a mulch pit, fill that with mulch, organic matter, cardboard, newspaper, rice husk, anything that can decompose down and feed the microbes and the worms below. Then you plant bananas around the outside and of the circle, and those grow down and their roots form like a net underneath. And that holds the whole thing together and supports it in a really beautiful, structured way. Then from there, we add loads of gills. We stack in the amazing plants. So we can plant papayas or mulberries or coconuts all amongst there. And then we can plant ground covers of sweet potato and taro and yams. We can plant beans to climb up and support the papayas. So we can make these a really amazing, abundant systems of tropical permaculture that is like ecosystems within itself. So a great way to take that even one step further is to cut the distance between the house and the banana circle by actually creating a banana circle shower. So you can grow your stand in amongst your amazing ecosystem of food and shower directly underneath this beautiful banana circle, knowing that the water that you pour on yourself is feeding directly down into the plants beneath you, which is then feeding you. So we can create these beautiful ecosystems of microclimates right at our doorstep, really, for a crazy amount of abundance.
This is our little participation on how to solve some of the biggest problem in the world. It's the human urine toilet. This one we call it the rocket toilet. So the way that works, you come up the stairs, you do your little business, cover it with some rice husk. Rice husk is the most locally available organic material. The goal of it is just to cover your business so that it doesn't smell, it doesn't attract the flies. People come and go, come and go, come and go, and we have good food here, so they come quite often. And once it's full, we just put the lid on, leave it for 1 year, and then we open the little door on the side, and we've got black gold. And how this really helps to save like big problems in the world is that by using no water at all, we don't have to like clean water to use to flush. At the same time, we get free fertilizer, and as many people, the more people actually come here, and the more fertilizer we have for our land. So we really like to have many people around. That way, it's plenty of fertilizer for our fruit trees. So if it's made properly, which this is a system that is actually very, very clean, there shouldn't be any fecal matter or any kind of pathogens by the end of the fermentation, and only like good mature compost. But here, because we are an education center, to make sure that like we don't spread any disease or anything, we never use this kind of compost in our veggie gardens. We always use it around the trees in the food forest. it's important to keep it quite dry. That's what really makes the difference. And a long-lasting process is like a long fermentation. Really helps to break down all anything that can be harmful for us. You might want to consider having some worms around. Because if you think about the inputs and outputs of having worms in a farm, and I'm not talking about the earthworms, I'm talking about these little guys here. These guys are called the red wrigglers. They are the ones that love to live in nice, fresh vegetables. They'll eat all your leftover food and transform that into worm cast, which is a very nice, strong fertilizer, very high in nitrogen. And also you get the worm juice, which you can just dilute with water and use as a fertilizer as well. The worms, they double their population within a few weeks. That will allow you to have some extra worms, and with these extra worms, you can also feed them to your chickens, and that's going to be always a very nice treat for them. So there is no waste with having worms around in a farm.
Out here in the fields amongst the fruit trees and the taking soil samples and things, it's easy to kind of forget about money and not think about it. But money is an important part of our lives. When we consider money and profit and economic yield on a permaculture site, we have to look at it from a couple different angles. We don't separate necessarily the enterprise of the family from the family life itself. So we can look at a reduction in costs to the family life similarly to an increase in profits from the enterprise. So what we're trying to do with permaculture systems here is both to reduce our costs, to reduce our fuel usage, to reduce the cost of all the implements and machinery that we need on site, to reduce the cost of labor, to reduce all our inputs like pesticides, fertilizers, those kind of things, reduce them down very low, while at the same time producing a product that's of higher quality. The organic and permaculture grown produce can get a much higher cost in the market. We can seek out niche markets. We can approach restaurants. We can approach hotels. We can approach CSA, community supported agriculture products, and see if our product can be sold through those avenues. Resources we have on site can be used in different ways, and when one stops being useful in one way, it can be turned into something else. For example, not far from me over here is a row of jackfruit trees. A healthy mature tree can easily produce over 500 kilograms of fruit in a year. That jackfruit tree can live to 800 years old, and at the end of its 800 year life, it's a high quality timber. That timber that can be then be cut down and put into a house that will last multiple generations. When that house is ready to come down and the wood starts to rot out, that wood can be pulled down and made into a chair, made into a piece of furniture. And when that chair starts to fall apart, that wood can then be used as kindling in the fire. And then when that fire is out, we can take the ash from that, put that ash in our compost pile, and mix it back into our gardens and grow another jackfruit tree with it. So this is the way we want to think in permaculture.
It's all like inside of us. It's inside of us. It's only been over the last like 50, 60 years that we've lost this knowledge, you know. It's inside of us, and I teach it, and then I see that people so fast, they learn so fast, they enjoy it so much as they go. And I really do think that it's only over the last 50 or 60 years that it's been lost. Before that, you know, my grandfather, he built his own house at the weekends whilst having a job during the week. And, yeah. I think people have a fear about it. They have a fear that they need to employ someone to do it for them, that they can't do it themselves, that we're told that we can't do it ourselves. And it's really not the case, you know, we can. And if you put your own energy into it, it becomes something different, you know. You've invested, it's like, it becomes like a piece of art. You've invested a piece of yourself in it, so it has so much more. You enjoy it so much more. There are many styles of natural building, and the one that we choose depends on the local context. It depends on the local materials available. Permaculture tries to draw from local, traditional, and indigenous knowledge and combine that with modern and appropriate technology. Concrete or cement has its place in natural building, but from permaculture point of view, we want to use it very mindfully and in the right places and the minimum possible. And it's very different working with adobe as opposed to concrete or cement, which is a destructive system, and in permaculture we're looking to move away from supporting destructive systems. The style that was chosen for this building is adobe. Adobe's been used for thousands of years. It's available to all. It's the earth underneath our feet. It's fun to do, and it can be done by anybody. You don't want more than 30% clay in the mix. The majority of the mix is a sand or some kind of binder. You can use coconut fiber or animal hair or chopped straw. So we can see the people behind me here, they're adding water to the pit. So we want to get the water proportions correct so there's not too much water. If there's too much, when we lift the forms, the bricks are going to slump. And if there's not enough, we'll have trouble lifting the forms up. A lot of people tend to put too much clay into their bricks. And if there's too much clay, they can crack, they'll come apart and crack, because the clay will expand when wet and contract when dry. We dry it out in the sun and it will go very hard and make a solid brick to use. We don't want the bricks to dry out too fast. We put straw over them so they dry nice and slowly. In this case, we're using shade cloth that we'll later use in our nursery on site. When working with natural materials, we don't need to use much safety gear because it's very kind to us. As opposed to working with concrete or cement, we need gloves. If we spend all day working with cement, we're going to have blisters the next day and our hands are going to dry out. Working with the earth, it's beautiful. It feels so natural. Here in the tropics, we want to design towards staying cool and dry, and also thinking about rains. A lot of this will relate to the roof design. So we want big overhangs on our roofs to protect our walls from the rain and the elements. Also, it multifunctions and it shades our walls to keep the interior of the house cool. We want to have openings in the roof so the air can flow through the house and create updrafts, which keeps the house nice and cool. Maintenance has to be done after the monsoon season here in the tropics, and that could be replastering a wall or often putting another lime wash on to protect from the rain and also to patch up some damage that may have been caused by the strong winds and rains that we get during that time of year. And it can be done together with a family or a group of friends, and it can be an enjoyable experience, but some maintenance is always necessary.
Projects here within the community we're really excited about is the earthen baking oven. Earthen ovens really bring community together. They bring people together. It connects us with our food source. It connects us with the elements of the earth. You know, when we've built this oven using the resources around us, using clay and sand. So this oven is being built not only to give the students an introduction to natural building and a first-hand experience of working with the materials and the resources that are just right outside of our door, they're all around us, but also because we are so excited to be baking bread and making pizzas and roasting a turkey that we've raised on the farm here. We're putting our oven here on this in this area that will become a really beautiful kind of garden patio, a sitting area for people to come together and relax and rejuvenate and have good conversation and prepare food. And it's going to be a gathering place for celebration. It's going to be surrounded by gardens and edible foods. You can go out and you can pick the herbs that you're going to be putting in your bread or on your pizza. Asia. And so it's going to just create a really beautiful space. Earth ovens are also super heat efficient, using all three types of heat, being radiant heat from the sun, convectional heat, which is warm air circulating through, and conductive heat, like frying an egg on a frying pan. Most conventional modern ovens use only one type of heat, being convectional heat. And that can leave a lot of air pockets, cool air pockets, and so you don't get as even of a baking. With the earthen oven, you have the radiant heat being stored in the thick earthen walls going back into the oven. We also have a thermal layer, an insulative layer, so that heat is not lost to the outside. The heat goes back into the center of the oven. Inside, the warm air is circulating. It's really steam-filled air, so you get this moist baking environment that really creates nice loaves of bread. And then you also get the conductive heat from the fire being built right on the bricks. And the bricks warm up at such a hot temperature that the bread or the pizza or the turkey is baking from below. So these three types of heat create a really even, efficient environment for whatever you may be baking. Stuff I really like to do is prep all my materials. A lot of times we're getting our clay from big piles or excavation sites or holes we've dug, and it might have chunks, clay clods in it, or stones or pebbles. And working with sifted material is so much nicer, and you're going to get a better product because you're not going to get air pockets and rock pockets where heat can get in and kind of burst open the area. Sand is also a good thing to sift. A lot of sand has rock chunks in it. So sifted material is great and a really nice step to include. So when it gets to be like you're happy with all the seams and its evenness, we're just going to let it sit. Don't go over it too much. And I know I repeat that, but it's so easy just to keep going over and over. But it's really detrimental for the, it's not as good for the clay. And remember, your oven is your own artistic, creative expression, so make it beautiful and put a lot of love into it.
Permaculture is about an assembly of elements, about how elements fit together and how they relate to one another. And one of the most important elements in any permaculture design is how the community fits into the design work. So today we have a very unique opportunity to incorporate elements in a community that we've never had before. Through the internet and just living in large cities, we're able to find people of like minds and assemble communities much more dynamically than we ever have been able to before.
My teacher, Christian, sent an email out inviting some of his previous students to this new project, which we didn't have a name for at the time, but I jumped on it. I was at home and spent the time and couldn't really handle the idea of staying in the developed world with intelligent people and watching all the problems and no solution in sight. So came here to learn what I could learn, and been here for 11 months now.
About 2 years ago, I was still in my final term of high school, and the project I gave myself was an in-depth study into Native Americans, because I've always loved them in terms of like the way that they were part of nature. It sounded amazing to me, and it sounded like a fairy tale. But anyways, I did all the research that I could on it. I read so many books on it, and I ended up wanting to study all aspects of the culture and actually try implementing like the way they built shelters and the way they made fire without matches and that kind of thing. And I started with fire and ended up spending the whole month trying to make fire without matches. But the point of that is that I had like a very deep passion for like these indigenous people who were around before, you know, technology and all that. Not that technology is evil. I'm not one of those people. But it's just there's still something very beautiful to me about that ancient lifestyle. If I reflect on that time now, 2 years later, it's pretty amazing to think about the kind of things that I've learned just by being here and living, and just it's a very real experience. And before, when I was reading these books, and it was all very fantastical, and it seemed like this dream that I could never achieve while I was living in a prep school dormitory, you know, in St. Louis, Missouri. It all seemed so far out of my reach. And in just 2 short years, I'm here.
As an example of this community here, I've been here now for about a little over a month. And I see this as one of those opportunities.
Kind of the age-old problem in society now, and people working their life away for retirement, and then they realize they work their life away for retirement. It's not a very healthy way to live, and it's very easy to avoid it if you just accept that you can't really control time, and time controls you more, and you have to work with it and just accept it.
We've been here now 8 days. Around there, and the transition has been huge for me personally, so much so that I almost can't remember what was going through my head 8 days ago. I know that for me as a nurse and traveling around the world and seeing what we're doing, not only to ourselves but the planet, has been almost overwhelming, to the point I've been stuck, kind of, not able to move forward, not even really sure what direction I want to go in. And really pretty bummed out and depressed about it. Traveling to places to provide health care to people and realizing that corporations got their head of me and they're drinking soda and their teeth are rotting out in the middle of the Amazon. I mean, it's been a crippling feeling. And so to come here and in 8 days lose a feeling that I've had for 15 years that's pretty mind-blowing, actually. I feel empowered. I feel like I can take the knowledge that we've learned and go back to these places I'm so passionate about going and working with the Maasai and giving them the tools that I've been given. And it didn't take that long. I mean, obviously, I don't have any as much practical experience as I need, but the knowledge is there now. And I'm really, really excited not to feel terrible. I'm really excited to actually feel like really positive change is possible without that much effort.
I just thought, like, how can I make this happen? And so I'm starting with food. I just really like good produce, and so I started looking into how to grow your own food in a very efficient way. That's where I came across permaculture. Permaculture is pretty much everything, I would say. It's just about life. So I cannot just looking at having good food. I have to look at everything to be fulfilled in life. Permaculture also includes community. So that conquers the next part. I want to create something nice for everybody that everybody can benefit from, instead of trying to focus on a career that's just about me but not about anybody else. Where I'm gonna end up, I don't know. But that's the beauty of it, just being in the moment and just stop trying to control. Just work with everything around you. That's you cannot force anything. You can try to force things, but you're just gonna create the opposite.
All of our mistakes, all of the great things we've done, and all the mistakes we've made, it's just been part of the process, and I don't regret any of it for a second, because I know I've learned a lot more from mistakes than from doing things the right way. Everything's connected, and everything's an opportunity to improve and to grow and to be better.
We live in a very
very exciting time, and we have a lot of opportunities available to us to share and contribute to a healthy and sustainable world. And we're going to be able to do that best through assembling communities that work together. That's what a lot of it is about, is building and creating fertile ground for a community to establish itself. And through that process, permaculture and these other elements that we talk about within permaculture design can begin to establish themselves.
Well, there you have it, folks. The audio excerpts from the 2013 film Seeds of Permaculture. You can have a look at that in its entirety on YouTube. Thanks to the filmmakers Ahuha. Their website is ahuha.com. AHOOHA.com. And we want to encourage people to remember that the Waipa Kalo Fest is coming up this Saturday, December 6th, and it's from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the beautiful Ha'ulu Fish Ponds. Be a lot of fun. Hope to see some of the listeners out there, and encourage you to stay tuned for Quiet Vibrations with Tracy, and tune in again next week for more stimulating thoughts and conversation on our relationship with the life of the land. This has been In the Garden on the Farm with your host, Paul. Thanks so much. Aloha.